Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and welcome again once again to the Socialist Insight. We are glad to have with us once again Alan Mackey. He comes on our program every other week, and he shares a lot of information in regards to U.S. government and also things that are being done within this government that influence and also have a big impact on working people. Alan Mackey, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the program today.
Well, thanks for having me, Stuart.
And Alan, you come on our program, as I mentioned, once every other week, and you share a lot of your vast knowledge of what is going on within this government, how it affects working people, and also where people can understand how this government actually works. A lot of people, we're dealing with a subject today which is called the real cost of U.S. imperialism, and that is a subject that many people hear from time to time. But they hear the word, I should say, U.S. imperialism, but they really don't understand what it is. And Alan, what I'd like for you to do to start our program today, just give a brief explanation. Explain what, when we say imperialism, whether it's U.S. imperialism or any other country, when we say U.S. imperialism, what are we referring to?
Well, in my opinion, as a Marxist, what we're talking about when we talk about imperialism is that it's the highest stage of capitalism, and it's the most barbaric and cannibalistic form of capitalism, where you have this merging of the banks and finance and industrial capital, and as they seek even greater profits than what they can in our own country through the exploitation of labor and the rape of natural resources, as they've been doing for several hundred years in this country, they put all this capital together, this wealth, and they take it overseas. And overseas, they begin to look for cheap labor to extract natural resources in the cheapest manner. And now in the stage of imperialism, we see that this cheap labor being used not only for the extraction of cheap resources, but for manufacturing. And, that has severe consequences for the American people as it does for people around the world. That would
now,
be
when,
my
you say, when you say using that type of power and influence to go into the global markets, is it where they can dominate within those markets to dominate those economies and also those resources?
Well, they're definitely. We have what's known as the G8. That's the United States, Great Britain, Japan, Italy, Germany, France, Russia, and Canada. I mean, these are the major imperialist countries in the world today where capitalism has advanced to the degree where this capital is now moving all over the world. And as a result, people in these other countries are rebelling because they don't want to be exploited and they don't want to see their countries raped of their natural resources. You know, this is only natural. We wouldn't want this being done in our country. And people across the world don't want it done to them. And as a result, people rise up, and then we have to send in our military to put these rebellions down. As far as I can see, the first real anti-imperialist in this country was Mark Twain, and he proclaimed that, I wasn't an anti-imperialist until the Spanish-American War. And that was our first war, first imperialist war that this country was ever involved in. And over 100 years later, we still have troops in the Philippines, and we still have control over Puerto Rico, both countries that we got in the Spanish-American War that we now have to, maintain control over. So imperialism is costing us a lot of money. It's very serious consequences for the American people. Obama's going to be talking about, five things mainly in his speech tomorrow: gun violence, immigration, climate change, pocketbook issues, and economic prosperity. Well, all those issues relate to imperialism for the American working people, and I think we need a great big dose of anti-imperialist education in this country if we're going to start to correct the problems of our country.
Now, what were some of the first signs that we could see in regards to when imperialism, U.S. imperialism, was raising its head within the global scene? What were some of the first signs? We know if we go back 160 years ago, we knew it was happening around the time of the Mexican-American War, and then we saw it around the beginning of the 20th century. But when did we really start seeing it? Because we have seen it all along. We have seen it back 100 years ago. We saw it around Vietnam. But what were the signs that, because we're going to get into some of the costs. The cost has continuously escalated from that point. But when did we start seeing the signs of this?
Well, I agree with Mark Twain that the Spanish-American War was the first sign that we actually had been developing an imperialist economics, and you know, we have been an imperialist country at that point, because that was our first imperialist war. I sort of think the war with Mexico was more of a, you know, involved with Manifest Destiny and everything. We hadn't the economy hadn't really reached the point of where capitalism had evolved into imperialism, and that's what we have now. I mean, we've gone through imperialist war after imperialist war. From, you know, all of Latin America, we've tried to undermine the people there by taking over their resources and using the people for cheap labor, and there's been rebellion after rebellion. The Wall Street Journal boasted a few years ago that in order to put down these rebellions, we had to kill like 15 million communists. And, you know, anybody that rebels against the policies of U.S. imperialism and Wall Street's grab for this wealth is automatically considered a communist and somebody that can be killed. Now we call these people terrorists.
Terrorists, right.
Yeah, and it's just...
Yeah, we don't call them communists anymore. Now they're terrorists.
Well, I'm sure it's going to get back to calling people communists as socialism begins to spread all over the world.
I mean, it's not funny.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And... I mean, the natural move, there's only people only got, like, as far as I can see, two paths that they can take in the world today, the path of capitalism, which is the path to war and economic austerity, or the path to socialism, which is the path to economic prosperity for working people. And more and more people will make this choice, so we'll be seeing more and more of the government of this country and the media talking about in these anti-communist terms like we saw back in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s.
Now, some of the things we're going to be also looking at, Alan, when we look at, you know, the budget for running this government now, is I remember years ago when it was when they were looking at approaching a $1 trillion, and now the budgets that they present to Congress are ranging in excess of $3.5 trillion. So it's become very expensive. And when you look at even just the military, the cost of the military and the defense, right now the U.S. government, we have over 765 military bases worldwide, which is an extreme cost. And what we want to do is dissect this and look at the cost of running this government, military, also the defense spending, which when you say defense spending, it covers other things other than just the military. But also this is taking away monies that can be used for many of the deal with many of the social issues that we have, such as education, house care, education, health care, and other areas. And then when we look at the further costs of U.S. imperialism, we're talking about how it is affecting other countries and the lives that are involved. Now, right now, as I mentioned, you know, when you look at the cost of running this government, it's a little over $3.6 trillion. We have a deficit, deficit spending that we do. Every dollar that's spent, 40 cents of it is just taking us further into debt. 40 cents on every dollar. We have the U.S. debt now is at 16.56 $1 trillion, so people can understand what that is. Now, when we look at all of this, when we look at many of the things that we're spending, how is this money being used to expand U.S. imperialism as opposed to taking care of the needs of our economy, especially when you look at the president? He'll be talking about his budget. But when we're talking in terms of over $3.5 trillion, what is going on here, Alan?
Well, this military budget, the militarism and the wars is killing, our jobs here in this country, just like it kills people overseas. And, if we begin to look at what we could have instead of this military budget and wars, we have to see that we could have a massive public health care system in this country, a national public health care system where everybody could have free health care and the people providing those services could be paid real living wages. And instead of 800 military bases around the world, we ought to be looking at having healthcare, community health care centers in every neighborhood and in every community across this country. And we could more than pay for that with what we're spending on the military. So, in addition to health care, we could have a national public child care system. And I don't know of any working class family where child care isn't a major part of their family budget. And they would love to have free health care, just like we send our children to school for free in the public schools. So, these are the kinds of things that we're sacrificing so that Wall Street can get rich and make greater profits in through controlling the resources of other countries. And that's the only reason we have to have these 800 bases, because the people begin to rebel, and these 800 bases are necessary to put down these rebellions and revolutions all over the world. And it's a vicious cycle, and we're suffering terribly as a result of these policies. We have to, at some point, we're going to have to challenge Wall Street for power, because Wall Street is not going to give up its agenda of seeking greater and greater profits. That's all there is to it. That's the nature of the system. That's the nature of the imperialist beast, you might say. And unless working people confront this and begin to discuss this, that's not going to change. I know, if you read all these articles by Paul Krugman and Robert Reich and a lot of these people, Joe Stiglitz, they all talk about this economic populism, but none of them are talking about what the military budget and these wars are costing the American people. So, we got to begin to focus on those things, and we can't allow these people to dominate the discussion in this country. It's this militarism and wars. This is the main problem in our country today, and everybody's trying to detract us from talking about these things. And
right now they're saying that the wars in Afghanistan, and again, that's another area of, when we talk about U.S. imperialism, that was a war that never should have happened. In other words, it was weapons of mass destruction, and this government, the leaders in this government, they knew it was never any weapons of mass destruction. But here we're talking about two wars that now is estimated that it's going to cost working people, taxpayers, cost this government well over $3 trillion for just those two wars, and that is still climbing. And much of the cost when you go into the war is not about just sending troops and the damage and the havoc that you wreak on those nations, but much of the cost is for reparations that are done, which also benefits Wall Street and is done at the cost of working people. But when what was that, Ellen?
The occupations of these countries is going to cost more than the actual wars to conquer the people. And, we've seen that with the Philippines, and we've seen that with Puerto Rico. And that's why I think we've got to take a good hard look at what imperialism has done and is costing us, because just the cost of these wars alone doesn't tell the real story. If we're talking about a 100-year occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq and some of these other countries, I mean, we're talking not just trillions, but trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars.
Trillions of dollars.
Korea, if we look at South Korea, what has it cost us to occupy South Korea now for over 50 years?
Right.
Just so Wall Street can extract greater profits by exploiting cheap labor in South Korea?
Cheap labor.
And that's what this is all about. And if you look at all where all these bases are all over the world, there you see Wall Street's interest are for to extract natural resources or manufacture using cheap labor. And so we're subsidizing Wall Street's profits. We pay and they profit. That's what imperialism is all about.
Now, Alan, some of the things that I want to get into, because we're going to dissect this, how it's affecting many areas. We have issues all over, and we talk about these on our show on a regular basis, such as I mentioned, health care. We talk about education. We're talking about just taking care of the needs of families, such as daycare, the needs for seniors. But when we look at right now, just the bill for education in this country, the bill that has already surpassed $1 trillion and is still climbing, over $1 trillion as far as debt that is already has been incurred, and we have students that have taken out loans like well over two decades ago, and they still owe more after 15 to 20 years than when they initially took out the debt. How, when we look at the correlation of what is being spent abroad and monies that could be used to take care of the needs, why is the cost being still pushed on to working people such as education? Is it only just priorities that we have? Are the priorities off, which we know that is the case? But why doesn't the government, why doesn't the U.S. government and Congress look at their responsibilities to their constituents and be able to reduce some of the nightmare costs that many working families have, such as the importance of education? Why?
Well,
because in any reasonable society, education should be a priority. But what is wrong with our political leaders that they have their priorities wrong in the 21st century?
Well, in this era of imperialism, everything is turned into a racket to make the quickest buck, the most profit for the Wall Street investors, or parasites, like I call them. The thing is, when we talk about the constituents from the members of Congress and the U.S. Senate or any of the state legislators, you know, their constituents are not us, the American people. It's no longer we, the American people. Their constituents
Good
are
point.
The corporations. Are the very corporations and the Wall Street profiteers who are making a lot of money from war. So these politicians are not going to act in our interest. If we want politicians to act in our interest, we're going to have to start a new political party, and we're going to have to start running working people for office who understand the nature of imperialism and are willing to stand up and fight for the control of this country once again so that we push Wall Street away out of power. We have to take this country back. Working people have to take this country back. You know, there has to be some kind of revolutionary change, whether it comes through elections or massive movements in the streets or a combination of those things. It's often been said the only way to stop these Wall Street people is through withholding labor. You know, are we going to have to start talking about a massive general strike in this country to bring our priorities into order? To where, you know, we insist that this money be spent on human needs rather than on, you know, these wars and militarism abroad. These are, you know, crucial questions we got to start to ask. You know, we got to keep in mind and we got to keep constantly telling people and explaining to people that these wars are killing our jobs and our livelihoods just like they kill people overseas. This is the nature of imperialism that has to be explained. And people are going to have to understand that, and at some point, when they understand that, they're going to have to take some kind of action in order to set things right in this country. And we can't rely on these politicians. You know, we can sign all the petitions we want. We can demonstrate at these politicians' offices. They couldn't care less. All they care about is the bribes they're getting from all these lobbyists from the corporations. They're laughing at us right now. They're not doing anything for us. Even the most basic things, the problems that they can solve very easily, they will not do. The reason they won't do that is because they don't want people to get the idea that people's power is actually influential. They figure if they give in on one little reform, people are going to want more and more and more and more. And that is exactly what happens because people begin to see the nature of the system and they begin to see that the wealth is there to solve the problems of humanity and of the people and of society. and people will keep moving. That's just the nature of reforms, and it moves us in a progressive direction, and these politicians are afraid of that. They're definitely afraid of this. You know, just the most basic things these politicians will not do to help people.
Well, you hit it right on the head, because the working people, the people of this country, they're no longer, probably they never have been, they're not the that's not their constituents. Their constituents are right there on Wall Street. Their constituents are the big corporations that they represent. So they will tax and use those funds to expand the interests of Wall Street. But in addition to that, they are still there only to represent those big corporations as they are expanding into the global market. But you know, when we look at, like as I mentioned, education is one area. We have seniors, many seniors, including people that I know that are close to me and my family. Retirement income, making anywhere from $600 to $800 a month on their income,
right.
And they can barely be able to take care of their own personal needs. They haven't much of the burden of for seniors is being placed on their families now, because the government has removed themselves from that responsibility, and that has been shifted onto families. When we look at health care, people are neglecting their health care needs, and again, that's a responsibility that the government should be able to step in and take care of the health care needs of the people of this country. But as you mentioned, they are not their constituents. Their constituents are there on Wall Street. So the priorities of this government have become completely shifted toward Wall Street, and not taking care of the needs of the people that live within this country.
If we look at just health care alone as compared to, say, education, you know, there's really no government service that's cheaper to provide for people than primary health care. If you walk into your doctor's office, you know, there's very little there. And we could have these primary health care centers all over this country for cheaper than what we can have public education. And yet
exactly.
We're being deprived of that because this government says there's no money for things like that, and they're paying for these wars. I can remember back in the 60s and 70s.
Back in the 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were all kinds of neighborhood health care centers where they had prenatal health care for women. They gave shots and vaccinations for free for people. All those things have been cut out now, almost all of them. And, you know, this is, rather than expanding them, they've been cutting programs that help people. And, you know, the only time that they keep any of these programs is when these profiteers can find a way to make a buck off of it now.
Right.
And just like education, the same people that make money from wars are making money off of books and, you know, reading materials and things that schools use. You look at a textbook, you know, why would it cost $100 to produce a textbook? You know, it doesn't even make any sense. Somebody's making a tremendous amount of money off of that. And, you know, all these things that the schools are buying, you know, they claim that our schools aren't properly funded. Well, the schools are being more than properly funded, but somebody's grabbing all of our tax dollars that are supposed to be going for education, and they're taking these tax dollars as profits.
Yeah.
Right.
We do have a caller. Evan, you're on the air.
Yes. I had a few questions for Stuart Alexander.
Yes.
The first one would be, I saw you on the Fox News show when you were talking about, you know, that you had been asked the question, what should be the right price for minimum wage? I think the question was, if $12, why not $70? And I don't think that they ever gave you a chance to answer it. My own answer to it would be, you can keep going up with that as long as there's still profit in the system. Because fundamentally, I think that, you know, if you eliminate the profit, you've eliminated the income inequality. Right. I mean, that's one thing that I would be, you know, gear my own answer towards that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, my question to you would be, do you have a different answer for that? I mean, I hear these types of questions a lot, and I don't think that there is a really solid answer for a lot of them. I don't know if you had a different one than the one you provided.
What is your first name again?
My name is Evan.
Evan.
Evan, I believe that people should be able to benefit from their own labor rather than someone else benefiting from their labor. When I think about the industry that I work in the automobile industry, and then you have, they say, I sell cars for a living. And they say, well, there's a national average of 8 cars per salesperson. Well, that eight cars per salesperson is not that a person can sell more or less, but the industry is designed to make certain that you keep that person only selling the average, that you just increase the number of people that you have selling cars in a certain workplace until you keep it down to that 8 cars per salesperson. In other words, to make certain you limit how much income. You can suppose that you say, well, if a person makes $2,500 a month, that's good. If a person makes $1,800 a month, that's good. But as long as you keep it at 8 cars per salespeople, you're okay. If you put in, if you have 15, and now that 8 car average has moved up to 11 cars, then what you do is you bring in more workers so that you can limit how much each person is making. In other words, there's a saying in the industry, you want to keep people hungry. In other words, you got to keep the salespeople hungry. What are you keeping them hungry for is so they can make more money for their masters, for the owners of those businesses, and you keep them struggling at the bottom. When they struggle at the bottom, many of them become very discouraged. They fall off. They can't meet their obligations, their needs, but they keep bringing in enough salespeople where the owners can still make all the profits that they need to make. But I believe if you had the same people that are working in those businesses, whether it's in shops or stores or manufacturing, and those people are benefiting from their labor, then everything is going to be different. Because first of all, what a person puts out, they'll be able to benefit from their labor rather than selling their labor at a cheaper cost or selling it to a certain person or corporation that they're working for. In terms of, is there a certain dollar amount that I look at what a person should make for a minimum income? I've had people say $10 an hour, and then other people say, well, that's not enough. I'm a member of the Socialist Party USA and been affiliated with the Freedom Socialist Party, which that's $15 per hour for both corporations. But let's look at in California. Can a person live on $15 per hour? I also lived in Florida. I spent time working in New York. In any of those three states, can anyone really take care of their housing needs, transportation, food, health care needs, everything that they need on $15 an hour, approximately taking home around $1,500 a month? Well, here in California, most times just to have a place to stay is going to cost somewhere between $800 to $1,200. That's if you look at just getting a one-bedroom apartment. It's not going to leave too much more where you can be able to take care of any of the needs. So I think if people make the income based on their labor, that income, rather than looking at how you can skim off the top what profits that should go to whatever owners, I think we would have a system that would be more equitable for working people.
And I agree fully. I guess, do you think then at any point, does the minimum wage actually being finally defined as $15 an hour or $12 an hour at any point just become a distraction to capitalism being the problem?
Right. Well, ultimately, we know capitalism is a problem, but I think the minimum wage should be set at basically at the cost of living, whatever the cost of living. And I'm not talking about some fabricated numbers that are done out of Washington, or I live here in California out of Sacramento or whatever, but that would be set by whatever state governments or federal government. And, of course, the federal government is the one to set the bar as far as the minimum. But, Alan, I want you to answer that as well, because Alan is our guest today. Alan, what would you say on that?
Well, I agree that the minimum wage should be tied, it should be legislatively tied to the cost of living factors, all cost of living factors. The United States Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics keeps all these facts. Every quarter, they published what the cost of living is based on, every single thing. And I think that the logical thing to do is insist that the minimum wage be tied to these cost of living factors in the different regions where they calculate, make these calculations. And, based on cost of living plus index to inflation. And the same thing should be done with Social Security or unemployment compensation or anything else. After all, think about it. Why should any working person have to do any job for less than what it costs them to live? I mean, that's just so basic. And,
the reason why I find this question so interesting is because I think the people that lean more towards the socialist side take the argument that you had used earlier, that people should not have their surplus production, right? They shouldn't have any portion of their productivity extracted by a capitalist, right? And the answer to the question about minimum wage is kind of this an allusion to that, right? It's actually saying that I think the minimum wage should continue to go up, right, until people that do the work are economically empowered with the amount that they've invested, you know, their time, their own productivity. I think they should get all of that back in return. And then the other answer is much more, I think, on the lines of the social democrat response, which is that we should get involved in the calculus, figuring out what it costs for a person to live and then adjust the minimum wage accordingly. And I think that to me would certainly eliminate a lot of human misery, but it doesn't address to me, I guess, a bigger problem. And I'm always interested in hearing how people respond to this type of question and how they come up with a response to it, because I see it a lot. But my other question, I have two other questions for you, Stuart. One of them is there's a subreddit. I don't know if you've ever heard of the website Reddit called R Socialism.
Right, I've heard.
I was wondering if you'd be interested in doing an IMA on there and actually answering some questions. I think it'd be a great opportunity, and we'd all be very interested in it.
Well, if you would send me some information in regards to what you would per your request, I'd be more than happy to look into that. People don't understand how taxing auto sales is, and when I tell people that on a monthly basis I work somewhere close to 250 hours a month, they say, well, where do you find any time to do anything? And I ask myself that same question every day, but
yeah,
because of my interest. But I literally I work around somewhere between 50 to over 60 hours every week.
Yeah, I also work in the automotive industry, so I know it's definitely taxing.
Okay, so you can relate. And what was the other question?
My other question is, I've been kind of vetting out this one as well, and feel free not to answer this one. In fact, I don't stress people do. But my problem is that I guess I'm fairly new to the political scene of socialism, and I guess my background is I was born in 85. That makes me relatively young, and I don't understand. Yeah, I don't understand a lot of the fissures that previously existed. So before I actually, demand you to ask this question, I'll give you the opportunity to hear an adage. I posed this question as well to James Harris, who is, of course, the running member, I think, of the 2012 SWP ticket. Right. So he was at a party, and I asked him this question. And essentially, I'm interested, where do you stand between the differences between the Socialist Party USA and the International Socialist Organization, the ISO, the SWP, and then this other group, the SEP, which so far, from what I've read, I actually see that I kind of identify more with the SEP. But do you take part in kind of – there really is no Venn diagram of ideals to help us sort these types of things out. Are there any of these parties that you feel a need to distance yourself from or you know, something that you know you feel that is you stand differently on?
Well, myself personally, the reason why I – chose to identify myself with the Socialist Party USA is because I believe in democratic socialism. I believe it should be in the workplace. I believe that within our communities, our schools, and those other organizations, they feel the same way. One of the things why I chose the SPUSA is recognized within this government, especially when you're running a political campaign, such as when I was running for vice president first in 2008. Initially, I ran as a presidential candidate, and then I was nominated in 2008 as a vice presidential candidate, but also in 2012. But it's recognized not only in the U.S., but it's very recognized worldwide. I think what it did is a lot of the ideas and wanting to share those ideas on a national and international level, that gave me more of an audience where people were able to see not only what the organization had to offer, but where I could share some of the other things that were going in the going on in the socialist movement. If I had been with many of those other organizations, including, as I mentioned, I'm affiliated with the Freedom Socialist Party, I would not have had that opportunity to come on many of the radio stations and TV stations, because people recognize that organization and the rich history that it has for over 100 years, even the Socialist Party of America, and eventually it became the Socialist Party USA as of 1973. As far as any of those organizations, I do not distance myself from those organizations, and I encourage, in many cases, for many of the leadership of those groups to become part of this program, because that gives them an opportunity where they can be able to come on and share with people like yourself, and be able to share on a national level how socialism can make a difference in our community. But Alan, again, I like to, since Alan is our guest today, Alan, what comments would you have on that?
Well, the only parties I really want to distance myself from are the Democrats and Republicans.
Well said.
I'm not really real sectarian. I have my own personal political opinions. But, you know, I sort of look at the different parties as being the embodiment of people get their ideas in different ways depending on, you know, what they do in life and everything else. So I'm not real interested in fighting against people because they're in this party or that party. I think we should all get together around some basic and fundamental issues and get to work in some kind of coalition. And, you know, all these differences of opinions between all these left parties, let's take care of those in debates or something, you know, like should be done. But we should start to work together, you know, to end these wars and the militarism and start to work towards some real meaning and reforms that will help, you know, get people over the hump as this capitalist system collapses. And, you know, it was brought up before that about exploitation. And I don't, you know, we have capitalism. There's no way we're going to get rid of exploitation under this system. We have to have a revolution to do that. But that doesn't mean that the reforms aren't necessary. Working people need these reforms to help them through these tough times that we're living through right now. And if we fight for these reforms now, it makes it a lot easier to, you know, if we have a revolution to build a socialist society, that will make it easier to, you know, to make the transformation. So I really welcome, you know, I don't think we can have too many left-wing groups myself as long as we start to work together. It's only natural that people are going to have this idea or that idea that's a little different than somebody else based on, you know, what they do in life and their position in life and everything else, you know. And personally, I would like to see a very strong communist party in this country. And, you know, that's where my personal opinions lie. But I also think a very big and huge mistake was made back in the 1930s when the Communist Party and the Socialist Party didn't unite and come together. I think we would have had, socialism in this country by now if that would have happened. And we shouldn't, you know, make that mistake again.
And Evan, I appreciate you coming on and sharing with us. Are you there, Evan?
Yes, I'm still here.
Evan, I'm going to give you my information how you can contact me. Just go to StuartAlexanderCares.com. That's StuartAlexander Cares, CARES.com. And there's a contact us. And then in that particular section, just click on that, put in those questions, the invitation that you had for me, and I would be looking forward to getting back with you on that. And I look forward to having you to come back and join us as a visitor in the future, okay?
Excellent. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan, we have a few more minutes here. I'm just going to take just a very brief moment just to introduce Alan Mackey. He's joining us once again. He comes on the program every other week, and he shares with us a lot of his expertise and knowledge about what socialism has to offer for working people, and also what he has been doing in the left movement and the socialist movement, and also as a communist for well over four decades. And again, Alan, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining the program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alan, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a few minutes. I want to, because when we look at the cost of just the military and what has taken place, people look at, they turn on this, the television, and the television, you really just get a watered-down version of what has taken place in the world. And the world is a very dangerous place today. And it's a dangerous place because the U.S. has made it a very dangerous place. We have drones flying over many many countries, including Yemen. We have them in Pakistan and many other parts of that world. And I was listening at, I can't remember exactly who it was that was speaking the other day, and they said, well, when we look at, when we do a drone strike, and that drone strike will take out whatever our intended target is, but, you know, certainly you have some civilian casualties, but you have to consider, you know, the nature of what our targets would be and the importance of what we can do to combat terrorism. And they were trying to minimize it, like that is very accurate, but whether they take out one innocent civilian or many children that we see in many cases. And I believe there's an estimation that for every target that they have, every individual that is targeted, they take out six innocent civilians, not to mention the cost that is associated with each one of these drone strikes. What I'm want to do, Alan, in the next few minutes, we want to explore some of the human cost that is involved with U.S. imperialism. Let's go back to Vietnam, a war that took the lives of 58,000 Americans and untold numbers in regards to the people that they were fighting in those countries. Look at Afghanistan and Iraq. People consider the cost of the U.S. military, how many soldiers that we have lost, working people that could have been working here in jobs and factories, but we have sent our children off to war, and not only many of them have died in combat, but we have had well over a million people, not to mention the additional casualties. But, Alan, when we look at the cost of war in regards to the human suffering and the human life that we don't see on television, share with us a little bit about what it is costing in terms of the human factor.
Well, the human factor, I mean, that's where the real tragedy comes in with imperialism. And, you know, like you say, we're not seeing that on television, and there's a reason for that. And that's because, you know, during the Vietnam War, the reporters showed us what was happening in that war. They showed us the obscenities of war. You saw people burning.
That's
napalm.
A good point. Could you share for our listeners what you could actually see on television back in the 60s during that war that we saw day to day?
Yeah, we saw people shot in the head, literally shot in the head. We saw burning children on fire from napalm bombs running down the streets. We saw the people's huts and where they lived set on fire and people shot down. You know, we saw all this on television, and this generated massive opposition to the war in Vietnam. You know,
what about the bodies that they were?
Today.
What about the bodies they were taking off planes every day? What about in the newspapers, they have page after page where you saw all the people that have been killed within the last week, within the last month. What about that?
Right. Well, we saw what happened. Bush didn't even want the caskets photographed of the GIs that were brought back in the body bags. They don't want to show any the consequences of these wars. They want us to think that wars now are some kind of clean things where you send in these drones to do this dirty work and you don't have to look at the children that are getting killed. You know, these helicopter pilots in Afghanistan that used little kids that were out gathering firewood, they used them for target practice. You know, they don't want the American people to know about all these things. This guy in Afghanistan, the U.S. soldier that went berserk or whatever, and he went and shot all these people in the middle of the night, he's supposed to be going on trial. We're not hearing anything about that. We're not hearing and seeing the pictures of what he did to those people. You know, the human consequences of war are just terrible, and anybody that's ever been in a war will tell you that. And that's why so many of these American soldiers are coming back totally nuts, because they just can't stand to see what they've done themselves and what their fellow soldiers are doing to the people overseas in Afghanistan or Iraq or any of these other places. And we've got a whole, I don't know how many thousands of these GIs coming back that are just totally nuts because of what these wars have done to them. They can't stand what they've done to people, you know, in these other countries. So they've gone nuts. And, you know, all these wars are resulting in nothing but violence in our own society. American society has become so violent that it's just normal for somebody to pick up a gun and shoot somebody now. You know, it's total insanity what imperialism has done to the entire culture and the society in general. And we're going to pay and we are paying a terrible price for this.
And we've heard some numbers just recently where they say as many as 30% of all of our troops that are coming back are having some type of emotional damage or physical injuries from this war. Over 30% that are coming from Afghanistan, and we're still at a period where this war, there's no end in sight. And
Is there no end in sight of this war, we're preparing for other wars at the same time. There's no end. It's perpetual war after war after war. There's no end. You might end one war, but you start another war when the occupations of the after the United States gets done conquering people in one country, they go to another war. And war has just become a way of life. It's the nature of imperialism. And it's this cycle of imperialist wars that the American people are going to have to break. It's the human factor is terrible. Our own people are suffering. You go through any Indian reservation and you can see the suffering. You just have to drive through an Indian reservation and you see the way people are suffering, the terrible, terrible poverty. No reason at all for it. The money going to war should be going to help people in these communities. It should be creating jobs where people can have meaningful lives, helping solve the problems of our society. Instead, you know, we might as well take these trillions of dollars. You might as well just take it out in the middle of, and dump it in the middle of the ocean for all the good that this money does.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrible, whether it's financial or the social cost. You know, Obama's going to be talking about climate change tomorrow, supposedly, in a speech. Well, you know, what industry has the largest carbon footprint of any industry of all? It's the military-industrial complex.
Exactly.
And we don't even talk about that. Just imagine, here in Minnesota, they say 40% of the iron ore that's been taken out of the ground, leaving us these great, big, huge, polluted pits now that nobody knows what to do with, they say 40% of this iron ore has gone into wars, whether it's tanks or airplanes or what the bombs. 40% of all the iron ore that's been mined in the state of Minnesota, which is the largest center of iron ore mining in the world, you know, 40% has gone into
40%.
War. This is terrible. You know, you have to stand on top of these great big pits and look down in them, you know, 1,000 feet down into the ground, and you say, what the heck? 40% of that went into production for militarism and wars? It's insane.
And, Alan, what I wanted to do is I want to get back to, we talk about the human suffering and what the cost is there, because that's the ultimate cost for any society. When we start losing our citizens to war, when we start losing our children, we can see when people are placed out of work, and much of the despair that has taken place in this country, and then usually you start seeing crime that is on the rise. As you mentioned, you go to many of these Indian reservations. I see here in California, you have these reservations where you see the big casinos and like that, and they say, well, the Indians are doing well. But if you drive through their communities, I mean, those people are living in poverty. I mean, where they're living in rundown homes, and they're not taking care of their basic needs, and they don't have they're not being educated how they can be able to take care of the needs of their community. I can see here in California, when you see a rise of homelessness, and that's, again, when you start using the monies for war, it creates human suffering here at home. But we see a lot of this that is taking place in our local communities, and we can't turn a blind eye, just like it's so easy to turn on television and they give you a blind eye, but we can't turn a blind eye to this because, Alan, this is reality today.
Well, it's
we see millions of people, tens of millions of people in this country, they're suffering because of war, because of expanding U.S. imperialism.
I get into people's homes probably more than most people, probably more than most social workers and other people. You talk about on the Indian reservations and these big casinos and everything, and the tremendous profits these casinos are taking in, and then you see all the poverty on the reservations where people have nothing. And, you know, I've been in people's homes, you know, just in the last few days. It's been cold here in Minnesota. A couple weeks ago it was down to minus 20. I went to people's homes. They were living in old dilapidated trailers, no heat or anything. All the kids were covered up with coats and rags, and I mean, it's just total human misery. There's no reason for this. Even if the profits aren't coming from the casinos to help the people, society still has a responsibility to come in and see that people are properly taken care of and don't have to live like this. And we can't have, like they say, guns and butter at the same time. We can't feed and properly clothe people and give people the proper housing and proper education as long as we're fighting these dirty imperialist wars. It's as simple as that. And people are going to have to come to that understanding if we're going to change things in this country. And, you know, every day I see this. I work with people that are trying to organize unions in these casinos. And among this massive wealth that's being taken in these casinos, people are working at poverty wages. People that are, they call them undocumented workers, illegal aliens or whatever, are being hired by these casino managements, and they're paying them as low as $5 an hour because they can get away with it, because the United States Department of Labor will not even come in and enforce the minimum wage. I just saw a notice where here in Minnesota, the Department of Labor ruled that the state of Minnesota violated the Family and Family Leave Act, for Family Leave and Medical Care Act. And they admitted that they found, the United States Department of Labor found the state of Minnesota in violation, but they said, we don't have the resources to recover what you've lost, so you'll have to litigate this yourself and go find your own attorney. Well, they don't tell the generals to go find more bullets for their wars. You know, every single thing in this country, no matter what it is, we're being told there's no money for this, no money for that. When it comes to human need, there's never any money, but there's always money for wars. And this has to be questioned and fought.
Alan, where do we start turning the tide where working people can – how do we start educating people and letting – the program, and Ruth Ann, she has been making this possible for us to come to our listeners every week. But how do we start waking up this nation? Because there needs to be a wake-up call. We're running out of time. And already when you look at the size of the U.S. empire, you know, many people are already saying, you know, the decline, when you looked at what took place with the Iraq war and what took place with Afghanistan, the signs are there that we're expanding to the limits. And when you look at the budget and how much debt we're going into, and it is not sustainable. When does a wake-up call, when people start realizing that, you know, before it's too late? How do we wake people up?
Well, you know, I've been talking to people for quite a while about this, and my personal opinion is that we have to get together and formulate some kind of statement about what kind of country we want and ask people to sign on to that, and then start building a political movement that's working towards that. And, you know, we got to have demonstrations, and we got to have start talking about shutting this country down and stopping the flow of profits, whether it's a general strike or, you know, some kind of massive demonstrations like they're having in Greece right now. And these are the kinds of solutions we got to begin to seek to the problems that we're having. Otherwise, the people that are running this country, they're not going to stop doing what they're doing until we exert some kind of massive pressure on them to do something differently. And they have to see that, you know, we're going to start challenging Wall Street for power, that we're not going to monkey around anymore, that we understand that we have to bring Wall Street down. And that's what we got to begin to talk about doing. You know, we got to begin to start putting socialism in front of people on their kitchen tables, where people begin to discuss socialism. Like they used to do when Eugene Debs was running for president, you know, 100 years ago, people would sit down at their living room and over dinner they would begin to discuss what kind of socialist society we want. And we just got to start talking to people is what it amounts to, and we got to bring people into activities where people are involved in protest, massive protest, not just little protest, but it has to be massive. And we got to get people out in the streets. I think that this Idle No More movement and the Occupy Wall Street movement were, you know, indications of the way we got to begin to move. It's got to be a little more organized, in my opinion. But, you know, that's the way we need to be going.
Well, Alan, I'd just like for you to give your contact information. Alan, I can't express enough how much we appreciate you coming on. The next time you got into something that, you know, we say, how can people get involved? How can we educate people? Next time you come on, we're going to talk about how the New Progressive Alliance, how they're making inroads and how they're creating an avenue where people can get involved. But, Alan, how can people reach you? And Alan will be with us 2 weeks from today, again, to share more with us. But, Alan, what is your contact information?
Well, the easiest way to get a hold of me is to call me. My cell phone number is 651-587-5541. Otherwise, just Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and you'll find my blog, the Podunk blog, and all my contact information is on there.
And, Alan, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining our program. What we're going to be doing next week, we're going to be taking a little bit different direction. We're going to be having Ruth Ann. Actually, Ruth Ann is the host for the program. And we're going to be talking about some of the things that has taken place in Israel and what has taken place with the Palestinians. We see stuff from information from time to time over the news media. And some of the things when we look at how there have been many issues affecting other races, we're going to races throughout time, whether it was with blacks or whether it was with Indians or any other group of people. And even some of the things that took place when we see what has taken place in Israel and with the Palestinians, what took place also in South Africa during the apartheid movement that I was part of back in the 80s. But anyway, we'll be looking forward to having Ruth Ann to come on. She is a sponsor for this program, but she'll be coming on as our guest. But until next week, we'll be looking forward to having you to join us once again on the Socialist Insight. Thanks again for joining the program.
Good show, guys.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Alan.
Yep, bye.
And thanks, Evan, for coming in.
Thank you.